This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. Welcome to the morning run on BFM 89.9, the business station. 6 o'clock, Thursday, the 16th of February. Good morning, Kusu Chuang.
Good morning, Melissa Andres.
All right. So we've got a great show lined up for you. So after yesterday's really impressive breakfast grill with Tan Sri Sharia from the chairman of Felda.
From whose perspective?
Well, I thought that was quite an interesting one. Simply to have him on the show
and
kind of, you know, address the controversies straight from the horse's mouth. You know what I mean? It's different to hear it. And then when you're reading it, it's one thing.
Correct.
It's been cleaned up. But to hear it from the man's mouth is really quite something else. But today, also another company that's been making headlines recently, Dago Ride. We're going to get the CEO of Dago Ride, Nabil Faisal Bamadaj. And if you haven't heard, Dago Ride is essentially the bike version of a ride sharing app of Uber or Grab.
Uber on two wheels. So it's interesting because Felda is obviously a multi-billion ringgit company, whereas Dago is it's a small, pokey little upstart which is, you know, disrupting transport services, ride sharing, as well as the transport ministry. What is interesting about Nabil's business is that he started off life, I think, with dispatch, same day delivery dispatch, and I think something happened. I'm not exactly sure what, but that business is going through some restructuring. So as I read from the reports, there's about 5,000 staff that is under him, that was under him in that business. So he's transmogrified that business to Dago, and Dago have got two services. They've got courier services, which is the dispatch business from before. And they've also got the ride service, which is new. Mm-hmm. And that ride business, intriguingly, does not make money for Dago, because whatever money from Dago Ride goes to the riders themselves, to the people who ride the bikes themselves.
Oh, right. So,
yeah, so
it's a direct transaction, is it?
Correct. So okay. I think you pay 2.50 ringgit for the first 3 kilometres. After that, I think you pay 60 or 70 cents per additional kilometre.
Right. So what's in it for him? How come he's providing the
precisely
service?
I think it's still... I think it could be employment for his riders from an ongoing basis. And in case you might be getting altruistic about this whole issue, maybe it's because he does not want to get the arbitration. Because if you let go of people, the labor courts and the tribunals are very, very harsh on employers.
Good point.
So I don't know.
He's run afoul with regulators or with the transport ministry, hasn't he? Over issues not just of safety, but is it of which categories?
Licensing,
yeah, right? Yeah. Which I find surprising because, you know, the government has made great strides in legalizing Uber and Grab. So, you know, now these ride-sharing apps are free to do business despite the objection that they initial objection they got from the taxi industry.
Yeah, so it's all a bit weird because right now there's a ride-hailing bill that is being, you know, channeled along Parliament, and but it doesn't include two-wheeled services.
Right.
Now, Bill's business says, hey, actually, there's nothing in the law to prevent me from doing so, but actually there's the SPED legislation, and there's the Road Traffic Act, which is also, according to Leo Tong Lai, the Transport Minister, Section 23, says that you can't do something. So...
Yeah, so I find that quite fascinating. You know, simply because I have to say, Chuang, that Grab has a two-wheel version in Vietnam or Myanmar. I'm not sure which country it is, but they also have introduced the Grab bike version. And in Jakarta, we have Gojek, which is also a two-wheel version of this ride-sharing service. It's clearly gotten great demand from these markets. I don't know why we can't seem to be able to implement it here. Because, you know, it may not be great. It may not be, as popular as Grab and Uber in the urban areas of Klang Valley. But, you know, imagine what this could do in the outskirts of Klang Valley, right? Outside of Klang Valley.
Yeah, so what I'm going to try and get a handle on is whether there's anything shady going on. Because remember, Uber and Grab, they used to be highly vilified by the ministry and the authorities.
Yeah, in the early days.
Mm-hmm. And then something happened, and then they got legalized, and then now suddenly, you've got people like, I think Coop is a small owner in Uber, and Kazana is also a small owner in Uber. Uber is a $51 billion company. So either they cottoned on to the fact that it's disruptive, mm-hmm. or they got some equity from the owners as a sweetener, Or I don't know why.
But, or it could be a populist move because, Chuang, according to the Edamame Trust Barometer, which is making headlines this morning, the government earned some brownie points in its move to legalize Grab and Uber. Yeah. It won a lot of goodwill from the public because, you know, it showed that they were willing to change and willing to embrace innovation.
Well, yeah, exactly. You know, they'll say that the people will say you've raised petrol prices on us. They'll say you've dropped subsidies. They'll say that now it's, you know, the cost of ownership of a vehicle is astronomical, has been astronomical. And then you also want to prohibit us from taking cheap transport services, which are disruptive and very useful. So, you know, so you're right.
I mean, this is fascinating. I look forward to this breakfast grill. The CEO of Dago Ride will be joining us, Nabil Faisal Bamadaj. Make sure you stay tuned for that. That's at 8 o'clock. And you know what? Why don't you send in your questions? You can WhatsApp us at 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll pass them along to Nabil. After the grill, we're going to take a look at the food flotilla for the Rohingya refugees. Now, this aid ship from Malaysia has arrived in Bangladesh now, carrying aid for some 70,000 Rohingya Muslims who have fled from Myanmar. And Chuang, this comes at a time where the Bangladesh government is pushing ahead with this really controversial move to relocate Rohingya refugees to a remote island, one that is, you know, the local authorities say that this island is uninhabitable and it's prone to flooding. So the Bangladesh government want to take the refugees and put them on this island. And their claim is that it will make it easier for the refugees to have access to humanitarian aid.
I feel so sorry for these refugees because, you know, they're unwanted and essentially Rohingya refugees are essentially, I think, Bangladeshi, part Bangladeshi in origin. So nobody wants them. And
I think the locals call them Bengali. They're viewed as outsiders, but they still refer to themselves as Rohingyas, a Muslim minority group.
Yeah, but that's terrible. I mean, anyone who's ever, and there are very few people in Malaysia today who have experienced, you know, the pain and peril of being a refugee. But, you know, obviously it wasn't that long ago that you've had World War II refugees. You've had people who have had up sticks and moved to Australia, you know, the Vietnamese diaspora. It is traumatic. It is painful. It is perilous. People die from crossing oceans.
Yeah.
And nobody wants that. I mean, it's really, really, really sad.
So just to quote a New York Times article, a refugee, the reporter who has spoken to the refugee quoted him saying that, well, if the Bangladeshi government wants something, we'll have to obey them. At the end of the day, what we want or don't want is not going to matter to anyone.
Yeah.
So there you go, like the hopelessness of the situation. And I have to say, photos of this this 6,000-acre island, it's completely undeveloped. It's only accessible during winter because parts of it are submerged. And, you know, there's concerns of kidnapping by pirates and fishermen. Yeah. So again, you've being thrown to the most unwanted parts of the country. We're going to be discussing that and speaking to several civil activists to discuss what's next for the Rohingya community, whether by leaving Myanmar and moving into this Bangladeshi island, will that finally resolve all the abuses that they've been facing? Or is it like jumping out of the frying pan into the fire?
Yeah,
so we spoke to Brad Adams from the Asian Division of Human Rights Watch, who thinks that relocating Rohingya refugees will not end the oppression suffered by the community.
Well, the Prime Minister of Bangladesh has long made it clear that she does not like the Rohingya. She has said some pretty horrible things about the Rohingya, about them being criminals. Sounds a bit like the way the Burmese talk about the Rohingya. She also believes that they would be recruited by the opposition party to support them as fake voters in elections. It's all pretty ridiculous. And so she is trying, on the one hand, to please the domestic constituency that doesn't want her to turn back the Rohingya Muslims from Burma, because that would seem heartless. But on the other hand, she's also trying to play to her nationalistic base to look like she's not having an open borders policy. So she's made this ridiculous proposal, and because this isn't even an island, it's just a mud pit that gets flooded at high tide and in the rainy season.
Yikes, that was Brad Adams saying that this island is essentially a mud pit. We'll have more on that issue at 8:35 a.m. If you miss it, you can download the podcast. You can find it on our BFM app at Apple, at the Apple Store or Google Play. 9:35 a.m. on Ringgit and Cents today. That's the show about all about personal finance. We're going to be looking at P2P lending and assessing the risks and rewards of investing in P2P. Christine Ng, CEO of PeopleLender, which runs the P2P lending website Fundastic.com, will be discussing some of the merits of P2P lending, which include interest rates of up to 18%. Sorry, that's you can lend that to SMEs. So we're looking at an investment size of as little as 50 ringgit.
So people can actually, enterprises, small businesses can borrow this money and have to pay an 18% per annum interest rate on that. Is that right?
I believe that's right, yes. I will have to find out more from Julian Ng.
Yeah, because that sounds astronomical.
That does sound astronomical, doesn't it?
I might as well just use my credit card.
I thought that was the returns, but who knows?
No, I don't think so. I mean, if you're the one who puts money into it as an investor, then you're going to get
18%. 18%
is huge.
Yeah,
right?
Well, let's find out more. I mean, this is precisely why we want to have Christine Ng on the show. What is interesting is that this is an SC-approved P2P lender. Recently, the SE approved six P2P lenders. So we'll find out what the safeguards are, what the risks are. More on that on Ringgit and Cents at 9:35. But very quickly, an update on the North Korean assassination at KLIA2. Police have arrested the woman who was captured by surveillance cameras at KLIA2 when the estranged brother of Kim Jong-un was allegedly assassinated. Bukit Aman said that the woman was carrying a Vietnamese passport holder, and they've got her, but they're still looking for other suspects.
Yeah, and apparently it's the revenge of the body snatchers, isn't it? Because Pyongyang wants the... Actually, Malaysian autopsy and pathologists have been conducting autopsies on the dead half-brother from another mother of Kim Jong-un. But the North Korean authorities are objecting to this autopsy for whatever bizarre reason.
Doesn't seem too bizarre to me.
It's like that Alice in Wonderland line. It just gets curiouser and curiouser.
Well, according to reports, North Korea sent a number of representatives to the hospital
to persuade Malaysia to not...
Can you imagine? But you know what? Good on Malaysia, because Malaysia says that it has not bowed to North Korean demands. One source told Reuters that Malaysia will not be pressured into anything. We will stick to procedure. But as yet, Malaysia has yet to confirm that the dead man is actually Kim Jong-nam. The deceased was travelling under the name Kim Chol. So, there you go.
Yeah. So, but actually, there's a lot of pictures on the internet, and he actually looks quite happy in some of those pictures. So, maybe it's because he's out of Pyongyang, that's why.
All right, well, moving on, another big story that's making headlines recently is the following the comment of the second finance minister, Datuk Sri Jari Abdul Ghani, that Malaysia has one of the highest civil servant to citizen ratio in the world. Now, the Congress of Unions of Employees in the Public and Civil Services, or CUPEX, they've come out to say, well, actually, the civil service does not need to be downsized in order to reduce the financial burden. In fact, they argue that the number that was given is actually far from the truth. He reckons, the head of CUPEX reckons that, in fact, the real number of civil servants is only around 500,000 if you remove military personnel, police personnel, doctors and teachers.
It's a definition thing, isn't it? It's a terminology thing. But at the end of the day, whether you're a teacher and classified as a civil servant or you're a teacher and not classified as a civil servant, someone's still got to pay the wages. Right? It's still a P&L issue.
Yeah.
The numbers don't go away. Just because you put one debt under another debt and then it's being serviced by another vehicle doesn't mean that that doesn't get paid.
Yeah,
that wage doesn't get paid.
So no matter how you calculate the end number, right, the number of civil servants, you know, you still spend this percentage of government revenue onto paying salaries. I'm not so worried about the government's, the civil service being bloated. I'm worried about it being lopsided. So I'm more concerned about the breakdown of, you know, how many personnel within the education system, within the health system, within security forces, and to know that, you know, we have more teachers than we do have people, bureaucrats, or people who facilitate bureaucracy. You know, you want them, the teachers, to be in the classroom as opposed to be sitting behind desks.
My concerns are multiple, but it's two key things. Number one is that the performance are not commensurate, to coin a labor phrase, with performance, because you might have you know, 270,000 doctors or half a million teachers. But where are the results? Where's the performances? Why are they not being employable? Why can't they speak English? Why can't they argue, you know, with a clear mind? And why can't they speak English, number one? And number two, the racial composition of government is over skewed in one direction. What kind of one Malaysia is this? So right. It goes against the narrative.
Well, the other issue this weekend is Himpunan RUU355. That is the rally that's held to galvanize support for past President Hadi Awang's private member's bill to amend the Sharia courts, or better known as Act 355. Now, Himpunan RUU355 is going to be held at Padang Merbot this Saturday, 3 p.m. to midnight, and police have assured that they will be on duty to ensure security there. Apparently, Dataran Merdeka and part of Jalan Parlimen will be closed on Saturday, so you might want to avoid those areas. Now, Chong, if you're confused about Act 355, Sisters in Islam is holding a two-day tweet chat session to answer questions on the proposed amendments to Act 355. I find this quite fascinating because Sisters in Islam, one of their key principles is that they say if Islam is going to be used as a source of law and public policy, then every citizen has a right to discuss and debate the matter. Which is a fair thing. And they're trying to increase the conversation, the dialogue around this, educating the public about Act 355 and the possible impact on Malaysians.
Fascinating. So, yeah. I'll be tuning into this tweet chat. I've never been to participate in
the one. You can follow it. So all you have to do is address your questions to the group's Twitter handle, which is at Sisters in Islam.
In full,
Sisters in Islam. And you can tag your questions with the hashtag #BetulkeRUU355, and that will be replied by the group's activist. If Twitter is not your thing, there's also an app now that is promoting understanding of Act 355. This is titled RUU355, and apparently it's been developed by Ilmiah Resources, which appears to have developed one other app called Majlis Ilmu Pulau Pinang. So apparently, there's a calendar of upcoming roadshows on this matter, collection of infographics, and also a forum space to talk about the amendments, among other things. So technology making headway into educating the public about Rang Undang-Undang 355. Okay, it's 6:17 right now. We'll be back with more discussion in just a couple of minutes, right here on The Morning Run, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Stuck in the Middle with You by Steelo Wheel there. Good morning, you're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Kusu Chuang here with me. It's now 6:23 on Thursday, the 16th of February. Chuang, if you're going to be travelling anytime soon, you might not need a boarding pass anymore because airports around the world are rolling out this facial recognition technology in an attempt to improve security and reduce the painful boarding process. I don't know. I mean, will it reduce? Sometimes I find technology slows down the process, especially when it's not working.
Well, it could be more welcome addition to the airport process because right now, trying to board a flight in a busy airport is akin to childbirth, actually.
Well, you know,
or pulling teeth.
Okay, so you know, aviation security has changed tremendously after 9/11, right? So we all bear this. We you know, just bear the pain of it because it's for the common good, right? It's for security. So you turn up at the airport 2 hours before you actually need to because you know it's going to take ages to clear immigration, and then after you land following a 20-hour flight, you're exhausted, and you know you still have yet another 2 hours to clear immigration.
I think laying an egg is less painful.
All right. So, but then hopefully technology might make it a little bit easier with facial recognition. We've got airports in Paris and Japan saying that they are planning to use this technology. I wonder whether, I mean, you know, it's a little unnerving because it's like biometric, but But, you know, it's all facial recognition, right? So what's stopping this technology from being used outside of airports?
Correct. Well, the future is here. I mean, look at credit cards. All you have to do is now wave a credit card at some small plastic box and miraculously money disappears from your account. The same thing, this company come from Portugal called Vision Box. Now, the reason I think Paris is testing is obviously in wake of all these terror attacks and Charles de Gaulle Airport specifically.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is you just, as opposed to your boarding pass, you just walk by the scanner and it scans your face. And then it just has these disturbing, you know, visions of agencies and firms doing, you know, face-off techniques or you know, putting other people's faces on
well,
you.
Well, I mean, technology can be a little racist. I don't know whether you know this, but, you know, I believe there was one facial recognition technology that refused to register an ethnic Chinese man who said the technology said that, you know, his eyes were closed because he had smaller eyes. And again, you know, because
I can laugh at that because I am Chinese and I don't have very big eyes.
But it's not just that. There was also a fitness tracker that refused to work tracking your pulse on darker colored skin.
Was that
wearers.
Right?
Yeah. So really? Again, you have all these different types of technology that's failing the different types.
It's gonna
of people
work
around
great for a white Swedish man from Gothenburg.
Well, you know, if it's the typical image of, you know, of what you expect, you know, a Caucasian child.
But you know what? This face recognition thing already happens and is already mainstream on Facebook, I think, because what it can do, it can just track the person's face in the picture and then automatically just tag that person.
Yeah, wow.
That happens already.
Okay, yeah. But there's no way to alter. I mean, you know, what if you gained a little weight? A little holiday weight from the way when you left.
Or the opposite.
That's true. I have to say, when I was reading this article, which was cleverly
disguised as a science
titled, what was that? Boarding passe. Instead of boarding pass. It reminded me of this, this experiment, social experiment that a podcast called Note to Self is embarking upon. It's called The Privacy Paradox, and it's how we let people, governments collect our data without a second thought. And it's almost as though we're too afraid to acknowledge what will happen and to do without. So I don't know about you, but I click on terms and services without even reading anything. I just click on it simply because I know, well, I'm not going to be able to change anything. I'll just click on it and then I'll get the service. I need to be connected. I need this app. I want to stay in touch with my friends and family. But it's gotten me thinking lately about what this data, I mean, who's got this data and what this data is doing. I don't know about you, but more and more I'm concerned that I'm giving away information about myself without even realizing it. And
well, my dear Melissa, you are an open book because, I mean, if we want to be connected, if we want to exist in open society today, we have got no choice.
You know, I don't think that's a zero-sum game. I really don't. Well, I don't think it's like, oh, if we want to be connected,
It is a now. It is a now, but you can imagine.
I think it is happening now, John.
I think it's
happening now, but I really don't think it's one or the other. That if you want your privacy, if you want to remain, you know, with a certain measure of control about how much information you put out there, it's not about not being connected. I really don't think not being connected is an option in today's day and age. You know, I mean, you can't do without your phone.
Well, I can. I would love to not have a smartphone. And there are a lot of people who live in the boondocks. Why not?
Could you be an urban global citizen in KL and not have your phone?
Yeah, you can't function. Like,
exactly.
I just give an example of a banker friend of mine. He was a huge Facebook enemy. And recently now he's on Facebook. He's got six friends and all of them are good.
Six friends. Oh, I love
think,
that.
But, you know, deliberately. But the point is, because now mainstream merchants and retailers and all kinds of entities that you deal with on a daily basis.
Right.
You know, it's so easy. They make it so easy for you to log in or to use their services on Facebook. So, you know, just people just sign up to Facebook.
Are
so
you
that
telling
you can,
me it doesn't creep you out? That
it creeps me out all the time.
That you see an ad that's a little too familiar or targeted to. Every time you see an ad that's targeted to you.
It's like flights. Now my Google and my thing, you know, the inbox or whatever, they know what time I'm flying tomorrow. And I've got no idea how they know.
So it's...
They send me reminders and I said, I didn't set this reminder.
It's, of course, the trade-off of convenience, right? The convenience that technology provides as
but
opposed
eerie,
to...
It's creepy.
It is. And it's that little... feeling that you get that, you know, this is somewhat dodgy.
They
this
know
doesn't
too much
sound
about
right.
Me.
Doesn't sound right. And I urge people to pay attention to that. I seriously do, and I believe that, you know, we've ignored it for a little too long. I don't know about you, but I kind of repress this concern.
Do you know what? Sometimes I visit websites that I don't normally visit, so I can throw the dogs off.
That's smart. That's
I go
smart.
To Popular Mechanic, for example, and then I just say. Just to put the dogs off the scent.
Sure, I'm sure that's so far removed from your daily life. Okay, it's coming up to news now, 6:30 with Lynn Mark on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Hen on the Run by Paul McCartney. Good morning, you're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Kusu Chuang, you're giggling behind me.
I think it's band, not hand.
Hand. 6:40 right now, Thursday the 16th of February. Chuang, do you watch Saturday Night Live?
I used to, you know, when Jim Carrey was a mere knee high to a grasshopper.
Okay, all right, fine. Well, I don't know about you, but I think Saturday Night Live has been on fire recently, especially.
I know what you do at night.
Yeah, well, you know, it used to be that you would watch an entire episode of Saturday Night Live, right? But now, you know, you can find tiny clips of really specific moments within Saturday Night Live,
and
it goes
viral. Yeah, this is the social media YouTube thing,
isn't it? On social media, that's right. And, you know, it's gotten a lot of people writing op-ed pieces about the importance of Saturday Night Live and how Saturday Night Live is now more vital than ever simply because of its ace mockery on Donald Trump. The recent skits that they've put on really encapsulate what's happening with, you know, current news. And it's almost to the point where satire is no longer satire.
It's almost real.
It's like The Onion.
Yeah.
And when The
yeah.
Onion is having trouble making up headlines that are more absurd than the actual news headlines of
yeah,
the day.
Yeah. So tell us, because, I mean, there was one about Sean Spicer and then obviously the parody about the press conference.
Yeah, so the latest, of course, has been Melissa McCarthy, who has just gone viral on social media, her take on, or her skit on Sean Spicer and
who's the press secretary for Donald Trump.
And the first press conference that he held, and which was, you know, a disaster. But all in all, Sean Spicer has a very specific style about him. He looks a certain way, and he has a shouty mannerism, and he shouts down.
A bit
down,
like his master.
Shouts down the journalist, and is a bit aggro, as the Aussies call it, a bit aggressive.
A bit like Donald Trump as well.
So Melissa McCarthy is she's a woman. So for her to be playing Sean Spicer, I don't know who looked at her and said, well, you know, we can make you up to look like a balding middle-aged white man. And she did. It was uncanny. It was amazing. But I do want to point out, Alec Baldwin as well, to the point.
He's the resident impersonator of Donald Trump.
Of Donald Trump.
SNL, yeah.
To the point where I believe a newspaper had accidentally used a photo of Alec Baldwin as Donald Trump. And captioned it, the U.S. president.
Who's the talk show host in the U.S.? You know, the Tonight Show guy. What's his name? He does a
Jimmy
very good...
Fallon.
Jimmy Fallon. He does a very good one as well.
Well, all the talk show hosts... I think have been using the Donald Trump administration as the butt of their jokes.
You blame them?
That's true. It does make for good comedy fodder. But I think what I want to talk about today is the importance of satire and keeping, you know, satire is part of a democracy. It's not something that we have here in Malaysia.
Correct.
Satire is not really.
I would love for us to have something like Jimmy Fallon's show, which I think Astro Awani is trying to do a little bit with Harith Iskandar.
Yeah, okay? not
but
quite.
Not quite.
Yeah.
Not quite. And, you know, with the Saturday Night Live show. And I think we've got the MACC, the thing of Chinese comedians. Mm-hmm.
There used to be that effing show as well. But I have to say, I mean, I wish our the tolerance for satire is a lot higher, because I do think there's something to be said about the ability for those...
Self-deprecation.
In the public to make fun of themselves. Correct. And to accept others making fun of them. It's really quite tough, you know, a country that doesn't accept satire as a form of, you know, of social
commentary. Well, it's human nature, Melissa, because, for example, you're a confident, well-educated, very independent woman, and you can take criticism, I think. You can take a lot of feedback on yourself, and that is the mark of a person that is sure of him or herself. Right,
I would love,
and it's like a government. If a government knows where it stands with its people, and it's doing the right thing by the people, and it's doing the right thing in general, it should be able to take feedback and criticism, and even parody and comedy. But it can't, which then tells you a lot, right?
Again, and you know the laws that we're bound by for communication within Malaysia doesn't recognize sarcasm or satire. I mean, how do you convey a tone of satire? How do you convey a tone of sarcasm? It's, you know, on a transcript, you don't see that.
Correct.
You see what the words
it's
that are
how
being
it's
said.
Delivered and how
yeah,
you look.
So
and...
I do wish that we had a little bit more tolerance for satire. I mean, Malaysia is so rich for satire. I think if there was a Saturday Night Live in Malaysia, think just how
open
funny that would be.
Open the front page of the newspapers, Star NST Utusan, and there is your script right there.
Exactly, exactly. Well, you know, today's papers, you can see even the North Korea assassination.
I thought it was satire, and then I realized, hang on, this is a real piece of news. It's
exactly.
Quite amazing.
So again, just to point out the importance of Saturday Night Live as a, you know, a platform for satire in the US, and it's really, I guess, you know, making lots of people, I think, were feeling a bit dejected after the results of the election. So perhaps this is one way of, you know, an avenue for people to get some measure of release.
Can I just say a couple things, right? Mm. Because in the same vein as this Daily Mail story about how a school yearbook, you know, and showed off the students all putting very, very funny and very self-deprecating remarks about their visual. So it starts in school. So I just want to point out, this has come from the UK Mail Online, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is interesting because, for example, there's a Muslim girl in here. Her name is Gufran Saleh. So she's probably from some African country. She's got the headscarf on as per, you know, a custom. And then her school yearbook message about herself is as follows. I got a haircut and no one noticed. And then this is Chinese kid who obviously is huge geek. He's a Chinese fella lah, or some Korean guy, right? Glasses on. He's got a tuxedo on, right? And his message about himself is not enough that I should succeed, others should fail. Very Singaporean, very kiasu, right?
Okay, so these are kind of high school yearbook
high school
quotes,
yearbook,
right?
The kids.
And I have to say, it's about making fun of yourself, about self-deprecation. You're absolutely right. The ability to make fun of yourself is important in, you know, a certain measure of humility. And
humility, one thing, self-confidence is another.
Ah, so right? It's a mixture of both.
Of course it
being
is.
Being confident and being humble.
Yes. Oh,
fantastic. My favorite is by Segun Aki Bogun. His quote is, "I'm that Nigerian prince that keeps emailing you." He's he's clearly from also the African continent. But again, you're right about making fun of ourselves. I don't know how many of us can.
Because if
do
we
that.
Can't make fun of ourselves and each other, then who can we make fun
Have
of?
Have you ever watched a roast?
A roast.
Yeah, you know a roast where you know, a person is the VIP of the day.
The kind of stuff you have on a Sunday afternoon with a glass of wine.
Not that kind of roast. But a roast where you know, you have your loved ones.
A roasting.
That's right. So your friends and family kind of make fun of the person of honor, right? And I can't remember who it was that I watched something on TV, and I remember cringing at it, thinking, oh no, that's so mean. Why would you say that? And all in good fun.
All in good fun.
But really, you know, when I was a kid, it takes a It takes a confident person Correct. To be able to sit to, through to give people and take making as well. Fun of you.
Correct. Like when I was in school, in a long time ago, let's just say last century, okay?
Sorry, many years ago.
But all of us kids, all of different origins and denominations, we used to make fun of each other all the time. And I'm not sure today that exists.
Yeah, well, you used to tell me of all the things that you used to tease your friends about, which were not quite PC, right? Not politically correct.
No, Indian fellas, Chinese fellas, Malay fellas, Eurasian fellas. There was a Jewish kid in my school. It was uncanny. He used to get the most of them off our
so
jokes
the ability,
because there's only one of him.
But then at what point does that not turn into bullying, Chuang?
We played football together. We ate together. We had recess time together.
So it's just ribbing, but good fun.
Absolutely. So today
no malice involved.
No, no. Okay. And today we're still in the same WhatsApp group.
Ah.
Yeah, so it's quite uncanny. Remember in the '80s, you told me this. And I hold it against you.
All right, it's coming up 2:50 right now. We've got news at the top of the hour, but before that, Jimmy Soul Clark with "Sweet Darling" on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.